It's a great pleasure to be with you today, and weather is beautiful, and it's a beautiful time of year. And also, incidentally, I have founded an organization called PURE, Parents for Unalienable Rights in Education, the purpose of which is to mobilize homeschooling parents and also parents who send their children to Christian schools and private schools, and even those parents who put their children in public schools, God forbid. But but some of them do, and they do have rights, parents' rights, even though they're not acknowledged by the state or by the educators. Nevertheless, they have rights. So I and several colleagues have created Parents for Unalienable Rights in Education in order to mobilize parents to defend parental rights, because as you know, parental rights have been under attack for quite a number of years. As a matter of fact, since probably 1900, when the progressives took over and decided that parents had no rights. And so we're really at that point in our history where parents' rights are going to be completely wiped out. That's a very important step on the way to totalitarianism. The state has got to control the children, and the state has got to deny the parents their rights. Well, in any case, we've created this organization, and one of the projects that we have is to proclaim a National Home Education Week. And this week happens to be the first full week in May, which began last Monday and will end tomorrow. And while we have proclaimed it, PURE has proclaimed National Home Education Week. What we are going to be working on for in the coming year is to get the President of the United States to recognize it and to proclaim it, and to get the 50 state governors to do likewise. And that will require a lot of work on the part of local homeschooling organizations, petitions, etc. In any case, I just thought it's rather appropriate that your meeting should be taking place during the first National Home Education Week this country has ever had. So that's a first step in the right direction, I think. I do want to open with a quote from Scripture from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. So you see, the Lord commands us to educate our children. And what the Lord commands, you do not need the permission of the state to carry out, you see. You see, that's what unalienable rights are all about. That's why this nation has such thing as unalienable rights, because our founding fathers were believers in the Bible, and they realized that that when God commands you to do something, you don't need the state's permission to do it. And that really is at the heart of the movement of this parents' rights movement, that parents do not need permission of the state to do what God commands them to do. And when the state begins to insist that you require their permission, then you know that the state considers itself higher than God. And, of course, that's not what this country is all about. It's just the opposite. As a matter of fact, I make it a point now whenever I travel across the country and visit a state capital to go into the capital buildings to see what visible signs we have of the Lord's sovereignty. And yesterday I was in Florida, in Tallahassee, as a matter of fact, and my friends there took me to the state capital, and I wanted to see what they had there. And on the Florida state seal, it says, "In God we trust," which is significant, and I'm sure that the ACLU will be working on that shortly to get that removed. However, I went through the House of Representatives and the Senate and the Supreme Court, the Florida Supreme Court, and I did not see any references to that particular a motto or to that particular seal. The Supreme Court has its own seal, very interesting seal with a Latin quotation, and they have a little booklet there that's supposed to describe the Supreme Court, the Florida Supreme Court, and the seal, but nowhere was there a translation of that Latin phrase. And I'm wondering what it is. I've written it down. I don't have it with me at the moment, but I'm going to, as soon as I get back to Boston, I'm going to look it up in my Latin dictionary. But I was surprised that they didn't bother to translate the phrase in the booklet that describes the seal. But you'll find in many states there are no references to God at all in the state capitals. The only state where I found really a couple of references to a higher power is in the state of Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg, and their Capitol building, and one of these days they'll probably paint over those also. I suppose we become rather cynical after a while about our government. But you know, and one of the things I like to do, especially at homeschooling conferences, is to remind the parents why they took their children out of the public schools and why they will not put their children in public schools. But also it's very useful for you to know and have these reasons in your head so that when you encounter your neighbors who question your wisdom and your judgment in having removed your children from public schools or not having put them in entirely, that you should have sufficient knowledge so that you can, argue with them or at least give them the reasons why you haven't put your children in public schools. And of course, there are many good reasons why parents should not put their children in public schools. You see, the children are at risk in four very serious ways. They're at risk academically, spiritually, morally, and physically. The academic risk is really extraordinary to think that in this day and age that we have children who enter our public schools at the age of 6 and emerge 12 years later at the age of 18 unable to read. As a matter of fact, we're creating in this country an underclass of citizens who emerge from 12 years of education with no employable skills. They can't read, they can't write, they can't add, they can't think, they can't even speak English anymore. They speak a new dialect. You've heard it on television, this new dialect. It's something entirely new. But for those of us who are aware of this, it's important to know why this is happening in America. Of course, the business community, everybody is up in arms over the fact that so many young people, so many young adults have such poor basic skills. I mean, that's why corporations are spending billions of dollars every year to educate young adults, to train young adults in reading, writing, and arithmetic. And incidentally, that's one of the great advantages of homeschooling. You know that your young people, when they go out into the working world, will have the ability to get these jobs. They'll be the first employed because they have the skills and the corporations won't have to spend any money to train them in basic skills. But you ask the educators, why are they producing so many functional illiterates? And of course, incidentally, they've promised to produce even more functional illiterates in the years ahead. Contrary to popular belief about the so-called reform movement and all of its great advantages or whatever it's supposed to do, the educators of America have warned us of impending massive failure ahead. They did that after a meeting they held on June 1st of last year in Washington, D.C. I happened to be in Tucson, Arizona on June 2nd, and that particular story made the front page headline of the Tucson Citizen. Young failures call peril to U.S. Unproductive children termed drain on society. As many as one-third of the nation's 40 million school-aged children are at serious risk of failing in school and society, which would create massive urgent problems for the nation, leaders of 11 education groups warned yesterday. Their coalition, known as the Forum of Educational Organization Leaders, said this potentially huge number of unproductive citizens will drain the economy and welfare and social service costs and seriously hamper the nation's ability to compete internationally. So there you are, in spite of all of the reform bills that have been passed by every state in the union at great expense to the taxpayer. They're telling us that they're not going to give us the excellence we want, that they can't deliver the excellence. Oh, either they can't deliver the excellence for one of two reasons. Either they can't deliver it because they're incompetent and can't deliver it. They don't know how to teach them. Or they have no intention of delivering excellence. Now, if it's the first, if they're incompetent, then they should graciously step down. They should resign and say, gee, guys, we can't do it. Why don't some other people who can produce excellence take our place? But no, they're not saying that at all. And of course, if they have no intention of delivering excellence, then they're deceiving and defrauding the American people, and they should be put in jail. Now, supposing the directors and the managers of the General Motors Corporation came before a stockholders meeting and told the stockholders that they intended to produce massive numbers of lemons in the years ahead. What do you think the stockholders would do to the management? They'd get rid of them, wouldn't they? Force their resignations. But here, the educational leaders of America are telling us that they intend to produce massive numbers of academic lemons in the years ahead, and there's nothing we can do about it. Absolutely nothing. So we know what they're going to give us. The American people are not aware of this. I was surprised to find this on the front page of the Tucson Citizen. I don't know if it made any other newspapers. It certainly didn't make the 6 o'clock news. I didn't see any references to this particular meeting or this particular report in any column written by any columnist or any editorial. And yet this is what we can expect. Oh, the educators are very frank. They want us to know what's going to happen. But unfortunately, the American people either don't hear it, their leaders don't hear it. Nobody seems to be listening to what they're telling us. So we know that we're going to have all of this massive failure. Now, if you ask the educators why are we going to have all of this failure? Well, they look at you with that arrogant indignation. Are you questioning our competence? They ask. After all, we are certified, qualified, stratified. Has nothing to do with what we're doing. We're wonderful. We're the professionals. We're the experts. Do you want to know why we're having all of this failure? We'll tell you why. It's because millions of American women insist on giving birth to defective children. That's the reason why. That's the reason why we have all of this failure, is because Americans keep giving birth to defective children. And we've got to deal with these defects. What do you expect us to do with children with minimal brain damage and minimal brain dysfunction and neurological impairment and attention deficit syndrome? Do you know what it's like to deal with children with attention deficit syndrome? You see. But of course, if you believe them, then I know of a wonderful bridge in Brooklyn that I'd like to sell you. See, we know why we have a reading problem, why we have functional illiteracy in this country. We've known it for over 30 years. We've known it ever since Dr. Rudolf Flesch published his famous book, Why Johnny Can't Read, back in 1955. Do you remember that book? 1955, some of you people weren't even born then. And yet we knew why we had a reading problem. Dr. Flesch told us, he said, look, Americans, there's nothing wrong with your children. They're not being born with all sorts of learning disabilities. They don't have minimal brain damage or minimal brain dysfunction, all these things you've been told. The reason why they're not learning to read is because of the way that they're being taught to read. He says they're not being taught in the proper way. He said the teaching of reading all over the United States and all the schools and all the textbooks is totally wrong and flies in the face of all logic and common sense. And then he explained how in the early 1930s, the professors of education changed the way reading is taught in American schools. They threw out the alphabetic phonics method, which is the proper way you teach children to read an alphabetic writing system. And they put in a new look, say, whole word, or sight method that teaches children to read English as if it were Chinese, an ideographic writing system. And he said, when you impose an ideographic teaching technique on an alphabetic writing system, you get reading disability. Now, what he said was true in 1955, and it's also true in 1988. Matter of fact, Dr. Rudolf Flesch wrote another book in 19, of course, the educators didn't listen to him in 1955. He wrote another book in 1981 entitled Why Johnny Still Can't Read. And in that book, he said, look, educators, I warned you in 1955 that if you don't change your ways, you're going to have a real catastrophe. And now we have that literacy catastrophe in America. And you read about it in editorials and newspapers, and they've got all on television, and they've got all kinds of adult literacy programs to take care of our 26 million functional illiterates and our 37 million semi-illiterates in America. And this is the nation that spends more money on education than any nation in the history of the world, and yet we have this growing problem of illiteracy in America. You see how the educators can so bamboozle us and so deceive us and play tricks with us so that they can get away with this, and they're still getting away with it today. Back in 1955, when Dr. Rudolf Flesch's book came out, the educators were absolutely livid with rage at this man. And they turned the entire teaching profession against Rudolf Flesch. They said, don't read this man's book. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a charlatan. He's trying to destroy American education. And they succeeded in maintaining their methods of teaching. And in 1981, when his new book came out, they didn't get excited at all. Their control of the situation now is so total and so complete, they don't have to worry about a man like Rudolf Flesch. Who bothers to read him? And if anyone does read him, what can they do about it? Nothing. In fact, what you have done is the only thing that people can do about it, and that is to remove your children from their jurisdiction, from their supervision, from their malpractice. Now, perhaps you don't know the difference between an alphabetic writing system and an ideographic one. Well, ours is an alphabetic writing system. Now, what does that mean? That means that we use an alphabet. Well, what is an alphabet? An alphabet is a set of graphic symbols, we call them letters, that stand for the irreducible speech sounds of the language. That's what an alphabet is. And all alphabets are the same in that regard. They all stand for the irreducible speech sounds of their respective languages. Now, the alphabet was invented around 2,000 years B.C. Now, how do you teach a child to read an alphabetic writing system? Well, since so many of you have been taught by the look-say method, I'd better explain that to you. It's done in three steps, and it was done very mechanically over the centuries. Remember, the alphabet is 4,000 years old, so people learned to read alphabetically for hundreds and hundreds of years in a very simple, mechanical way. First, the child is taught to recognize the letters of the alphabet. That's not difficult to do. ABC song, etc. The second step is to teach the child the sounds that the letters stand for. And that was done very mechanically for hundreds and hundreds of years. As a matter of fact, if you've ever looked through an old New England primer, this is the way they did it. They would teach the child, for example, that the letter B stands for the consonant sound B, or that the letter M stood for the consonant sound M, and then they would join the consonant letters with the vowel letters, and they would drill the child in the consonant vowel combinations in column form, such as baby by bo bu, may me my mo mu, ba 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 ba, ma 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 ma. And now the reason why they drilled the child in those combinations was so that the child would develop an automatic association between letter and sound. So when the child sees the letters, he hears the sounds. That's the heart of learning to read an alphabetic writing system, because an alphabetic system is a sound symbol system, just like musical notes. I mean, a musician sees the notes on a page of music, and he hears the music. A phonetic reader looks at the page, and he hears the sounds. He hears the sounds of each syllable and the words as they as he reads, you see. And once that is accomplished, step two, then he goes to step three, where he reads words and sentences and little stories. Now, the earliest form of writing is known as pictography. The cavemen drew pictures on the walls of the cave, and you didn't have to go to school to learn to read them. I mean, a man looked like a man. It was usually a hunting scene or a battle, you know. Animals looked like animals. Bows and arrows looked like bows and arrows. However, as civilization became more complex, the scribes had to begin drawing pictures of things that did not lend themselves to depiction. I mean, how do you draw a picture of good and evil, or right and wrong, or such concepts as easy, or facilitate, or accept, or accept, or method, or system, or process, or determine? How do you draw a picture of determine? You can't. So what do? You draw a little picture and you say, this stands for determine. It doesn't look like determine, but it's determine. And the scribes drew thousands and thousands of such little symbols, none of which looked like anything they represented. And so now you did have to go to school to learn to read. Somebody had to tell you what all of these crazy-looking symbols stood for. And I don't know if the other day when I was traveling on a plane coming from Tallahassee to Jackson, I noticed in the, where they have the instructions, or the safety instructions on the plane, they now have them in various languages. And I was looking at the chart, and it was in English and in French and Spanish and German, and then they had it in Japanese. And you look at these squiggles, and it's awfully hard to make out what they mean. And I tried a little exercise to see how many of the same squiggle I could find in a line and that sort of thing, but it's not easy. Now, modern Chinese is an ideographic writing system. The Chinese have 50,000 of those little squigglies, none of which look like anything they represent. I mean, you've seen them on Chinese menus, and you know that the squiggle for an egg roll doesn't look like an egg roll. Or the squiggle for a chicken chow mein doesn't look like chicken chow mein. And it's a very difficult system to master. As a matter of fact, it is ideographic writing. They call them ideographs, incidentally. Not idiot graphs, but ideographs. The ones we use in America today are idiot graphs. You know, the ones you see on all the, now the ladies and men's rooms and in the airports and all these wonderful pictures all over the place just to take care of our growing illiterate population. Idiot graphs. But anyway, it's very difficult to master all of these ideographs, and so it's not an easy system to learn. However, about 2,000 years B.C., somebody made a remarkable discovery. Somebody living in the area of what today we would say is northern Israel and southern Lebanon, somebody discovered that all of human language, everything we say, is composed of a small number of irreducible speech sounds. And so that individual said, gee, instead of using this cumbersome system comprised of thousands and thousands of symbols, none of which look like anything they represent, why don't I create a small set of symbols to represent the irreducible speech sounds of the language, and then we will have a very simple, direct means of transcribing the spoken word directly into written form, and an equally easy means of translating the written word back into spoken form. And so the first alphabet was invented. And now, as I said, that the all of human language is composed of a small number of irreducible speech sounds. How many irreducible speech sounds are there in the English language? I'm sure there are some people here who know it. That's right. Only 44 sounds in the entire English language, and we have a vocabulary approaching a million words. Incidentally, one of the reasons why the Chinese have fallen so far behind Western civilization, and we know they're a highly intelligent people, is because of their writing system. Their writing system prevents them from developing language. Because who's in charge of the squigglies? You can't go around making new squigglies in China. But as you know, with alphabetic writing, you can invent new words every day. Even kids invent words. I remember when I first heard the word nerd. What's a nerd? That's a complete invention, a nerd. Can you imagine trying to create an ideograph to stand for nerd? But so we only have 44 sounds in English, but we use a 26-letter alphabet. How come? Why don't we have a 44-letter alphabet? Well, you see, when the Romans conquered the British Islands, they imposed the Latin alphabet on the people who lived there. Now, the Latin alphabet was invented for the Latin language. The English-speaking people never invented an alphabet of their own. So they adapted the Latin alphabet to their needs. Now, if you're going to use 26 letters to stand for 44 sounds, you're going to have a bit of a problem. Some of your letters are going to have to stand for more than one sound, and some of your sounds are going to have to be represented by combinations of letters. For example, our typically English sound th is represented by th, the sh is represented by sh, the ch is represented by ch. Our letter A stands for at least four sounds. It stands for the long A, as in apron or April. It stands for the short A, the A, as in apple or cat. It stands for the ah sound, as in father or car, and it stands for the or sound, as in all or fall. Now you might ask, how does a child learn to distinguish which sound is called for when he sees the letter? Well, he does that by learning the spelling families. And generally, when you teach a child to read English by intensive phonics, you start, say, with the short vowel spelling forms, and then you go to the long vowel spelling forms, etc. And in a very systematic way, the child learns the sounds and the different spelling forms of the sounds. You know, for example, take our A sound. Long A is spelled in at least five different ways. A consonant E, as in late, mate, rate, R-A-T-E. It's spelled A-I, as in made, paid. It's spelled A-Y, as in say, pay. It's spelled E-Y, as in they, obey. It's spelled E-I, as in vain, rain, etc. So, and how do children learn to spell? You've got to teach them the spelling families. They don't do that in American schools anymore. You know how they teach spelling these days? Invented spelling. You've heard of invented spelling? Kids now are told, well, you just do it any way that sounds all right to you. And so it takes a child maybe 3 or 4 years before he finds out how to spell a word correctly. And you can imagine how angry the child must be when he finally finds out, you mean that's the way it's spelled? Why didn't you tell me that in the first place? He would tell the teacher. And I don't blame him for being angry at today's teachers who say, go ahead, reinvent the wheel. Find out how to spell it correctly through your own method. Well, what is he going to school for if he's going to do it on his own? You see. Well, that's the way they teach children to read in America. Now, how do they teach children to read by an ideographic method? How can you teach children to read English, an alphabetic writing system, as if it were Chinese, ideographic? Well, they do it. I'll tell you how they do it. When I first heard about it, I thought it was insane. I thought it was crazy. I said, how can you possibly teach a child to read English as if it were Chinese? Well, they do it, and they're doing it right here in Jackson, Mississippi. They're doing it in every state of the union, in every school district. Every school district. Here and there, there may be an isolated school that teaches intensive phonics in the first grade, but that's a rarity. Well, this is how they do it. They do teach the child step one, to recognize the letters of the alphabet. I think they do that because they know that parents would be very upset if the children didn't at least learn the ABC. But then they skip step two. They don't drill the child in the sounds of the letters. They certainly don't do any baby bibo bu. But then they go directly to step three and teach the child a sight vocabulary. Now, a sight vocabulary, by definition, is teaching a child to read English words without their knowing the sounds that the letters stand for. As far as they're concerned, the letters have no meaning whatever. They are arbitrary squiggles arranged in a rather arbitrary, haphazard way. Child has no idea why those letters are different, or why they are shaped the way they are, or why they are arranged in the way they are. He is supposed to look at each word as if it were a little picture, a little ideographic symbol. Let's take, for example, the word horse. Now, how would a teacher teach the child the word horse? Well, first she'd put a little frame around it. And she'd say, see the little horse? Now, so the child has to look at H-O-R-S-E and see a horse. Now, you and I know that H-O-R-S-E doesn't look like a horse. So how does a child see a horse in that frame? You know how? Any way he can. The educators have known ever since 1912 that children couldn't learn to read that way. The first study was made in 1912 of how children learned to cite vocabulary. And they found out that kids were reading words upside down, doing all kinds of strange things. So that's the first thing they do, is they put a little frame around it. Well, of course, they know that that's not enough, so they say, okay, we will also... Incidentally, the little frame is called the configuration clue. The configuration clue. Then what they do is teach the child picture clues. They give the child picture clues. In other words, when they introduce the word horse, they will have so many pictures of horses on that page that the child will just assume that the word says horse. But of course, you can't always have pictures of horses every time you use that word, because there are other things to be illustrated. So they provide what they call context clues. In other words, when they introduce, or when they use the word horse, they'll use it in such a manner that the child will, in such a context so that the child will conclude that the word must be horse. For example, they'll put it in a sentence such as, the man put the saddle on the, and the child will think, well, it could be a camel, could be a donkey, but it's probably a horse. And then, of course, to reduce the ridiculousness of the guesses, they say, okay, we will teach the child phonetic clues. Now, here's where things get sticky, because if you go to any one of these public schools that are using a Basel reading program, one of these look-say Basel reading programs, and you ask them, do you teach phonics? They'll say, oh, yes, we teach phonics. Phonetic clues is not intensive systematic phonics. What they're doing is they're simply teaching the child beginning consonant sounds so that if the child sees that the word begins with H, he'll know that it couldn't possibly be baloney or barbecue, but it could be house, hotel, hovel, hearse, or horse. So what they do is they reduce the ridiculousness of the guessing. And as a matter of fact, a leading professor of reading in the United States, Professor Kenneth Goodman, calls reading a psycholinguistic guessing game. And that's what they've made it into, a guessing game for the children. In fact, he told a reporter from the New York Times that if the child sees the word horse and says pony, that's correct. because he's seeing the picture. And if the child sees the word father and says dad, that's correct. But as you can see, whatever happened to the phonetic clue? These people contradict themselves. These so-called educators contradict themselves, and they don't. They just assume that the public won't catch them, because this is much too rarefied, much too difficult, and it's all clouded in professionalese that the average parent cannot figure out what in blazes is going on. In any case, that's how they teach children to read, and of course they produce highly inaccurate readers. I'll tell you how look-say readers read, because I've trained them to become phonetic readers through my alpha phonics method. I listen to them read. You will find that some of them can read rather rapidly, but you, as they are reading, you notice that they're leaving words, leaving out words that are there. They may be small words, but they're important to comprehension. They don't see them. Then they're putting in words that aren't there. You see, they're rewriting and editing as they're going along. Then, of course, they guess at words that they're not sure of, words they don't know. Guessing is perfectly normal in that method of teaching. They encourage guessing. The educators encourage guessing. And then, of course, when they come across a big 50-cent word, you know, the multisyllabic words, they just assume they don't even have to read that. They'll just skip over it, you see. And the result is, of course, that you get terrible reading comprehension. I mean, how can you possibly understand what you're reading if you're going to leave out words, put in words, omit words, jump over words, misread words? And incidentally, these youngsters are not even aware of the errors they make. They also do something very peculiar. They truncate words. They'll see a word like newspaper and they say paper. They see a word like telephone and they say phone. I mean, it says telephone, but they see phone. I don't know what they see. Maybe they see a phone booth. Or maybe they see a princess phone. Who knows what they see, you know? But that's the way they read, and that's the reason why we have this reading problem in the United States. Now, you might ask yourself, oh, incidentally, this method of teaching also produces the symptoms of dyslexia. Because what are the symptoms of dyslexia? Errors in reading, poor memory in memorizing word recognition, reversing of letters, reading words backwards. Well, of course some of these kids read words backwards. If you're told to look at each English word as if it were a little picture, how do you look at a picture? Always from left to right? I mean, when you go to a museum, do you always stand on the left side and work your way across? From left to right? No, you look at a picture any way you want to. Right, left, right. So they do read words backwards. But that's a serious symptom of dyslexia, you see. Now, you might ask yourselves, well, don't the professors know that they're causing the symptoms of dyslexia? Don't they know that they're causing reading disability? Don't they know that they're causing inaccurate, imprecise, poor readers? Well, what do you think? You think that having used this method for over 50 years, they don't know what it's causing, the damage? You don't think they know what they're doing? If they don't know it's causing such damage, such poor reading, then they're so incompetent. It's beyond comprehension how anyone can be that competent and still remain at their jobs. An entire profession. Publishing houses, professors of education, graduate schools of education teaching this garbage. And they don't know what they're doing? I doubt that. I think they do know what they're doing. I'm convinced of it, as a matter of fact. And I've done the research that has convinced me that not only do they know what they're doing, but they're doing it deliberately. And that's what they want. They want to dumb down this nation. They want to produce a nation of people who can read at a very low level. Very low level. Why? Well, you see, the men who invented this were the progressive educators back in the early days of this century. As a matter of fact, the late days of the last century, John Dewey and his whole crowd. These men were the men who created this system of teaching. They were the nation's leading educators. They were the world's leading behavioral psychologists. They devoted years and years of study in laboratories of the human brain and of human behavior. Now, they were also socialists. And they wanted to create a socialist utopia in America. Now, why? Well, because they no longer believed in the religion of their fathers. These were men who were members of the Protestant academic elite who no longer believed in Christ, in Christianity, in the Bible, even though they themselves had been brought up in good Christian homes. And they now put their faith in science, evolution, and psychology. And as far as they were concerned, that answered all of the problems. Now, these men had to deal with the problem of evil. And they felt that socialism provided them with the means of dealing with evil, with getting rid of evil. You see, the Bible tells us, gives us the origin of evil, tells us why men do the horrible things they do, because we're born with this sinful nature. We are born innately depraved, as John Calvin put it so quaintly. Or we are born with original sin, as Catholics put it. In other words, man's fall in the Garden of Eden had resulted in a terrible tragedy, and all of us have inherited the results of that tragedy, the sinful nature. Death was the result. We all die because of what Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden, you see. Now, if you don't believe, and incidentally, the Bible does pose this terrible problem. It tells us what we are, but it also provides a solution. It tells us that, yes, man, you do have this sinful nature, but you can still lead a happy, productive, and long life, provided that you live within the parameters set forth in the Bible. Provided you live within God's word, God's commandments, God's laws. If you do that, then you can have a happy, long life, productive life. In fact, if you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior, your sins will be forgiven. And we all need forgiveness of sins. And of course, you will be saved and have eternal life after death. So the Bible poses the problem of evil, but it provides a magnificent solution for all of us. But if you reject that as fairy tale and fable, you've got to come up with your own explanation for the cause of evil. And these men analyzed this thing, and they said, well, we know what causes evil. It's ignorance, poverty, and social injustice. And so if we want to get rid of evil, we've got to get rid of social injustice. And what causes social injustice? Well, capitalism, this horrible economic system of ours, individualism, and religion. Religion is the culprit. Why? Because in the Christian religion, the idea of a utopia is preposterous. There is no such thing as utopia. We want utopia. We want a perfect society. We want perfected human beings, moral perfection. And that's why they decided that they would put their ideas into practice, because they had to prove that they were right. How could they prove that they were right unless they put their ideas in practice and produced this utopian socialism? Then they could say, see, we told you so. The Bible is fable. It's fairy tale. This business about man's basic depraved nature, his sinful nature, is totally wrong. We've proven it to you. We've shown to you how we can get rid of evil, how we can produce perfect people. So they embarked on this messianic mission to change America from a capitalist, individualistic, religious nation into a socialist, collectivist, atheist nation. Now, John Dewey did a very detailed, intensive analysis of the education system at that time, because he was convinced that the capitalist system The Christian religion was being sustained by the education the children were getting. And in analyzing that education, he said, the culprit is high literacy. Because high literacy produces independent intelligence. It produces people who can read the Bible and who can know God directly. And he said, we've got to change that curriculum. We've got to create a curriculum that will produce little socialists. Well, how do you do that? He said, well, we've got to downgrade the teaching of the academic, the intellectual, and the literacy skills, and then we've got to put the emphasis on the development of the social skills. Group behavior, feelings, emotions, values. Today we call that the affective domain. The educators call all of that subject matter dealing with values clarification and sex education and all of that. That's the affective domain. And that's where the shift is. And that's why we produce kids with such a low level of academic skills, but an intensive level of socialization, peer dependence. They're only interested in behavior. And so when the child enters the first grade to learn to read, their primary purpose is to remove the child's brain. And the way they do this is through a non-surgical prefrontal lobotomy. You see, they've got to get the brain out of that child's head. You see, now, because every child comes to school with an incredibly working brain. You see, every child teaches himself to speak his own language virtually from birth, so that by the time he's ready to go to school, he has mastered his auditory and verbal skills to such a high degree that he has a speaking vocabulary of between 5,000 and 35,000 words. See, every child teaches himself to speak his own language all by himself. So every child is a self-learner. Every child is a natural-born learner. And so by the time he's ready to go to school, he's a dynamo of language learning. A dynamo of language learning. And the teaching of reading in the alphabetic manner simply accelerates this learning process so that his vocabulary expands further. So what the public schools do today, what the Look-Say method does today, is it brings this language, this dynamo, this incredible language learning energy, it brings it to a screeching halt. It stops it entirely. It blocks the learning process. And as a result, then when you bottle up all that learning energy, what happens is the child becomes hyperactive. I mean, the energy's got to go somewhere, so that he becomes hyperactive. Little monster in the classroom. They're turning him into an airhead with a lot of physical energy. And then, of course, the behavioral psychologists have the means of taking care of that. They now drug the kids. They give them Ritalin so that their behavior, they can manage them in the classroom while they're removing their brains. See, the child knows that this is being done to him in the school. He knows something. He knows that he entered the school feeling very intelligent. Very intelligent. Any child who teaches himself to speak his own language is very intelligent, wouldn't you say? And yet in 1 year's time, he feels dumb. He says, I can't learn. And they put him in special ed. He's labeled learning disabled. He's labeled minimal brain damaged. He doesn't know that his brain is actually being removed or destroyed. He doesn't know it. He knows something terrible is being done. All he knows is that his brain, something has happened. He started out feeling very intelligent, now he feels very dumb, very stupid. And then, of course, what they do is they drug them and turn them into little zombies in the classroom. So that's what happens in today's, that's the damage they're doing to these youngsters academically. It's a crime. It's a crime. And anyone who puts his child in a public school, and you've just heard what the educators are telling us, how we're going to have even more of these, because they have no intention of changing the way they teach reading. All you have to do is go to the next convention of the International Reading Association that's going to be held in Toronto and look at the books that are going to be bought by your school districts here, and you know that this business of producing functional illiterates is going to go on for years and years to come, because there simply is not enough knowledge among the public, among parents whose children are in the public schools, and there simply is not enough political power on our part to change things. I mean, it could change overnight if you had the Mississippi legislature pass a law mandating the teaching of intensive phonics in the first grade. That would begin to change things. But, oh, you can get the Mississippi legislature to reinstate compulsory school attendance, but try and get them to mandate the teaching of intensive phonics and see how far you'd get. So this is what we're up against. And you homeschoolers who now know how to teach your children, and incidentally, I know that many of you were taught by the Lookse method yourselves and have problems teaching your children to read. There are several good teaching programs on the market. Mine, the Alpha Phonics book, is very direct, very simple. However, if you've never isolated the irreducible sounds yourself, then you might get something with a cassette tape. And I know that Sue Dixon's Sing, Spell, Read, and Write, she provides it in tape form, so that if you yourself have problems identifying the sounds and hearing them and teaching them, that's a solution to the problem. I'll probably be bringing out a tape with the sounds also, because I've come to realize that there are many homeschooling parents who were taught to read by the look CC method and have problems of their own. But if you do have reading problems of your own, you can help yourself by teaching your children phonics and learning to read phonetically and improve your own reading skills. So I will end on that note. Have I completed my hour? Have I? Okay, and I will see you later on and continue in discussing the other risks involved for the youngsters. Thank you very much.